Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Artificial intelligence rapidly transforming the way that we create content. And certainly, as a radio station, we are seeing that tremendously. Mavis asking a very, very relevant question. Is the Morning Mayhem jingle AI, or is it a person singing? So, Mavis, it's actually a combination of everything. And that's what makes it so interesting, is we write the lyrics, then you feed certain information into it, and you come up, or AI assists you to come up with the product that you want. Now, the question, of course, is, well, what happens now? Because if we provided the lyrics, but some of the music and some of that was provided by AI to that in fact generated it, who actually owns that content? Joining us to help us try and understand the legal, the technological, the practical implications, we're joined by Jan Vermeulen. He's editor at My Broadband. Jan, a very good morning, and thank you for joining us. I hope you're well.
Good morning, Howard. It's a pleasure to be here.
So great to chat to you. It really is becoming more and more interesting. I mean, if I write an article and before I submit it, I put it into one of the platforms to correct it and to offer suggestions, does that then, do I lose control of it? Do I still retain it? Take us through how this is evolving.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation here in South Africa because based on a legal opinion that we published over the weekend, it's pretty clear cut in South Africa, but elsewhere in the world, it is not. And so now the examples that you gave, so the reason this is relevant, right? So for example, the jingle that you spoke about, if there is no clear cut ownership of copyright, then somebody could take that the mute. So if you say you've written the lyrics, then that's pretty clear cut. You own that copyright.
Right.
But if it's unclear about the music, the melody, if there's no clear delineation of whether there is copyright there, then somebody else, a competitor, for example, could lift that jingle and use it for themselves and not infringe your copyright, right? So This is why it's important to know, this is why ownership is important, and especially for businesses, but even individuals who produce content and are trying to monetize it. If you've interacted with an AI or if you've used an AI to help you, have you given up ownership? Because that could affect whether you can assert copyright over that thing and earn an income. Now, your example of using an AI to help you with a grammar check, I think is a little more clear cut.
Right.
There, you've written the whole work, and you are simply using an AI to help you clean up the grammar. So that's more clear cut. But if you've used the AI to help you generate pieces of the text, then what, right? And so this is why this is relevant. And what the legal opinion that we got said was that in the South African context, it seems pretty clear cut until there is case law to suggest otherwise. And that is that the person who typed the prompt owns the copyright. That's in South Africa. So in South Africa, it seems pretty clear cut. And so even though an AI might have generated the content at the end of the day, you who wrote the prompt for the AI own the copyright. Where things get interesting,
because that kind of makes sense.
Agentic AI, that's more automated.
Oh gosh, yes. Because I mean, AI is just really a tool, and you using a tool to create something. It's almost like a paintbrush, maybe. It doesn't mean that the paintbrush owns it or nobody owns it because you've used a fancy paintbrush. So that I kind of get. But when it comes, but now you're going to talk about agentic AI, which really does confuse it, because that in many ways acts on its own.
And it can, but it still needs to be triggered by a prompt. And so in the South African context, I think there is something to be said for the person who created the agent, right, owns the copyright within this context. But to your other point of, you know, is AI like a paintbrush, or is it more like an assistant, right? So now this is where things get opinionated. And so a writer whose work I enjoy a lot, his name is Brandon Sanderson, he would argue that using AI to create something does not make you an artist. It makes you more like an art director. And so there's a distinction to be had there. But for copyright purposes in South Africa, mercifully, I think it's still clear cut. But yes, there's an interesting debate here about whether AI should be seen as yet another tool in your belt. So as a writer, is it like, you know, is it just like using a dictionary or a word processor or Grammarly, and it's just like another evolution of that? Or as an artist, is it like, you know, going from canvas and paints to paint shop to stock imagery, et cetera, or you know, as a video editor, same story? Or is it more like you have an assistant who you have told to do something and it produces the work, and then you two have co-created this thing, and so in that sense, you are not necessarily the artist, but more of a director. But for copyright purposes, I think that argument is moot, because even when there's an art director and artists, usually what happens is the copyright vests in the parent company, right? So when you create movies and so on together with a huge team of people, then rather than individual copyrights resting with individuals who worked on the project, it tends to vest in the parent company that paid for the whole thing. So there is an interesting, I think, philosophical debate to be had. Yeah, part of the other philosophical debate is, but what about the individual artists whose content was slipped up by the training data, by the AI companies to train their models?
Yes.
Do those original artists not deserve compensation for the work that this AI is effectively reproducing and selling as its own? And that's where things get hairy and interesting and really untested in terms of copyright law globally.
So the reality is, though, that within probably a year or 2 years, everything is really functioning utilizing AI. Whether we actively realize it or not, we are influenced by it. Our technology has it embedded in it. You're not going to be able to really separate yourself from that.
Right. And here's, I think, something that might blow people's minds is, if you've had a modern smartphone in at least the past 10 years, your photographs have been AI enhanced automatically, probably. These smartphone camera apps do all kinds of clever things behind the scenes to make the images come out better, whether that's automatic color correction or focus adjustments or stabilization, framing, all kinds of interesting things that existed long before LLMs and agentic AI. And so AI is already, as you say, deeply integrated into the technology we use every day. There's now just a much more obvious thing where you interact with a system and ask it to do specific stuff. And that raises all kinds of interesting ethical and practical and legal questions. But the fact is that all of us have been receiving some kind of help from AI in our creative endeavors, whether that's from spell checkers or your photo app in your smartphone, or content-aware fill in Photoshop. We've all been using some form of AI for a while, and the question is whether this new generation of tools is so materially different from what we've used in the past that it needs to be treated differently. Now, there's artists out there, especially writers in Hollywood, animators, and soon there will be professionals, whether it's lawyers whose knowledge get captured in these AIs, engineers, doctors, that then can be used as experts on call for people. Now, we're not there yet because the AI still hallucinate a lot, and there's no real guardrails to check that what they tell you is accurate and true. That's essentially the vision and the goal for many of these AI companies. And so there's an argument that still has to be had, and a fight that still has to be fought there, about if you slurp up people's talent and knowledge and experience into these models, should they get compensated or not? How do you even manage that at a global scale?
The other thing, of course, and I see it with my daughter at university, is that's a huge, huge issue. How the universities are dealing with this, and the checks, and the like. To me, it feels like a fantastic waste of time in reality, because it's sort of rather teach people how to deal with it than just say, well, you know, we're going to test it to check. It seems to me that the universities aren't quite there yet.
It reminds me a bit. I've got parents from the baby boomer generation, mm-hmm. and so aunts and uncles and stuff from there. And so they lived through a very similar revolution. And that revolution, people might be also have their minds blown to hear, was the pocket calculator. And so universities had to adapt their curriculums, and schools as well, from using slide rules and sine and cosine tables to adapting to the pocket calculator. And it took years. It wasn't overnight. But honestly, we live in a much more technological information age. We have to adapt faster. We don't have the luxury of simply banning the pocket calculator from classrooms. This technological advancement is happening so fast and it's so pervasive. The change that needs to happen to me is no different than the change in curriculum that had to happen to adapt to the pocket calculator.
I agree.
And switching away from putting an emphasis on doing the maths in your head versus
to verifying
and
checking.
To multiply by hand.
Yeah, and 100%. That is where we need to leave it. Such an interesting conversation, Jan Vermeulen. Thank you, as always. Jan is the editor at My Broadband.